This is lesson number 6 in the mystery of providence, covering chapters 4 and 5 this week on our employment and our family affairs. And before we get into the chapter proper, are there any questions about the style of the book or things that have been written through these first 5 chapters that you guys have? There may not be a whole lot of time for questions later on, so I thought we'd open with a time to make sure everybody's keeping up with it. Do you like the way it's written? Has it been a useful book? I think he has a...
picked it.
I did. I picked it. That's right. Yeah, next year we'll see if they've got a Mad Magazine version for you, Brad. I don't think the Puritans were in the comic books, but we'll see what we can do. All right, well, let's take apart this chapter on our employment. Some of the elements in this book, in this particular chapter, may seem a bit dated, but I think they still have some relevance for us today. And the first point Flavel attempts to make here is that God directs us, and directs you, to a calling in your youth, and not permitting you to live an idle, useless, and sinful life. Now, I suspect for the most part, a blessing in this manner may seem hard to appreciate. I would suspect among this particular crowd, for the most part, there is a high value placed on work, but that value is not alike for all people. Some people have a real problem in understanding the importance of being called to work. So let's look for just a minute at the first text that we have, Genesis 3:19. And I deliberately decided not to spend much time on thinking of the doctrine of work prior to the fall, but it is well worth considering in just the briefest sense that work itself is not sinful. God created Adam. He created the world, and what he did was good. And he had commissioned Adam to tend and keep the garden and to put him to work. So work is, in fact, a wonderful institution. But after the fall, people have often come to the conclusion that because of sin, we have work, which I think is a terrible conclusion to make here. But let's read verse 19. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. It's clear that God still has in front of us the directive that we are to work. And it is a real gift of God to be saved from a life of useless idleness. It's a gift of God to be preserved from sitting by idly. Now, there are obviously many people who desire to work, and they may be out of work for the moment. Europe is having a real crisis of employment. Their numbers are, I think, right about twice what ours are in the country right now. But we can see that these are people who, for the most part, probably would like to be gainfully employed, but due to circumstances outside their control are not right at the moment. So we're not talking about those folks. We're talking about how God saves us from being useless and idle. There's a real gift there. There's a real gift to be able to be put to a productive use in society and in our families. Well, how does God do that? How does God keep us from sitting by in an idle way? Well, it's God who provides the opportunities to work. Now, if we have gainful employment at the moment, then we should acknowledge God's hand in protecting us from idleness. You see, it's a blessing in disguise. We should look at it and say, God has been good in keeping me from sitting by idly by giving me work to do. Now, we might prefer to have our hand put to another form of work, but that's not really the question before us. We have the opportunity to be diligent and be protected from laziness. And there are a lot of people out there today who do not see the value of work. A lot of people. And their situation in life is one of sin. It is a sin not to work. Now, there'll be a couple of occasions this morning to kind of question the idea that the work in which we are currently employed is the... You might be led to think that what Flavel's saying is that's the only job we should be doing, and that's not what he's saying. But before we express too much dissatisfaction in our current employment, at whatever level that is, as a student or in a professional situation or managing a household or whatever the environment is, we should abound in praise that God has saved us from being idle. Let's look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, and we'll read a section there that I hope will come fresh to us in the importance of work. We have Paul addressing these saints for the second time and has some clear words of instruction for them. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, starting in verse 6. But we command you, brethren, in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly and not according to the tradition which he received from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow us, for we were not disorderly among you. Nor did we eat anyone's bread free of charge, but worked with labor and toil night and day, that we might not be a burden to any of you. Not because we do not have authority, but to make ourselves an example of how you should follow us. For even when we were with you, we commanded you this: if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. For we hear that there are some who walk among you in a disorderly manner, not working at all, but are busybodies. Now those who are such we command and exhort through our Lord Jesus Christ that they work in quietness and eat their own bread. But as for you, brethren, do not grow weary in doing good. And if anyone does not obey our word in this epistle, note that person and do not keep company with him, that he may be ashamed. Yet do not count him as an enemy, but admonish him as a brother. Now, one of the themes that Paul is trying to communicate is that we should not act in a disorderly fashion. We should not be a disorderly people. And to that end, he communicates one aspect of disorderliness in a failure to work that you might at least provide for yourself, and if necessary, a family. You see, you're considered to be disorderly if you will not work with your own hands in whatever capacity you may to provide for your family. Paul warns against all kinds of idleness and the dangers associated with it. His example here before us is not intended to be prescriptive in the sense that pastors should not be allowed to draw some form of remuneration among their congregations. He had a right to this. He had the authority to be paid for the work that he was doing. But in Paul's opinion, it was more profitable for him to be at work with his own hands providing for himself as he was establishing these churches. Now, this idea of the ceaseless giving of Paul is found in a number of places in the New Testament. We see examples of this in his life in 2 Corinthians. But I'd like to focus here that the picture is one of work, and not of just work in general, but work in quietness. That we're not to be a people who are drawing attention to ourselves, or that we are somehow living a life that attempts to put ambition above all other aspects. We're called to obey the Lord Jesus Christ in all that we do, and we are to have to eat our bread in quietness. That's a different picture sometimes than the boisterous ambition that is often associated with being a career individual. So there are several ways in which we can fall off the wagon when it comes to looking at the doctrine of work and how God orders things. The first is that we can cease to work and become idle and fall into many temptations. And the second is that we work in a way that exalts work over all other aspects of the Christian life, and we don't do so in a quiet fashion. Well, turn over, if you will, to 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy chapter 5, and we'll look at another warning given by Paul that has a very particular application. And we'll... He is speaking here, we won't read the whole passage, but he's speaking of these younger widows, women who for some reason have lost their husbands, but are not of the class of widows that some have conjectured that are old enough not to necessarily marry again and bear children, but these are the younger widows. And he's specifically addressing one of the temptations that comes to these women. And we'll pick it up in verse 13. And besides, they learned to be idle, wandering about from house to house, and not only idle, but also gossips and busybodies, saying things which they ought not. So he commends them in verse 14 on the positive things that they should do. He's warning them here on the wrong things that they are to avoid, but then he tells them they should marry, have children, and create a home. But it's interesting that he links together the sins that are associated with idleness. These women, because of the idleness in their life, because they don't have anything productive to do, they run out and become busybodies and gossips, and they wreak havoc on the church. Proverbs 19:15 tells us that laziness casts one into a deep sleep, and an idle person will suffer hunger. Now, I don't know if you recall, but in our introduction to Jonathan Edwards' Charity and Its Fruits, we played an excerpt of some biographical information given by John Gerstner. And one of the things that Gerstner made a point of was the diaconal work of Edwards in his ministry there in Northampton. And one of the overarching principles he had was that it was a sin to feed idle people. It was a sin to feed the idle. It wasn't an act of charity. And today, we often cover that sinful idleness that many people have with government-sponsored charity. Now, if a man doesn't work, he ought not to eat. If he is incapable of working, you know, obviously there's room that we can exercise charity, and that charity should be close to home and within the church. But you see, what God is attempting to do is by giving people the natural inclination to want to eat, also corresponding giving them the method to do so, and that's work. It's a protection of God against certain patterns of sinfulness in a man's life, or in a woman's life, speaking generically here, that he gives people the desire to eat, and he gives them the means to go about securing satisfaction to that end. Laziness is a sin. And when we as a country subsidize that sort of sin, we are subsidizing sin itself by encouraging indolence. So when we look at the protection that God gives us, we should see in his providence he creates opportunities for us to work. And that is a tremendous benefit, because it's easy to be lazy, especially if someone else will take care of the bills. It's easy to be lazy. All right, section 2 on lawful callings. It's a very short section, but I think it's worth remembering, especially as people are venturing out into the collegiate world and thinking about careers they might have and what we can lawfully put our hand to. But another evidence of tender providence is made known in ordering you to such callings and employment in the world as are not only lawful in themselves, but most suitable to you. And he uses several examples in the negative on how people were given over to unlawful callings, and particularly how they hurt the church. And one of the examples given was that of Demetrius, who made shrines for Diana. Now, there's nothing inherently sinful with being a silversmith. There's lots of productive uses for being a silversmith. But here, Demetrius was involved in a way that provided only an avenue for not only idolatry, but for harassment of the church. And it makes you wonder, well, what are some of the things that we could be employed in that might not be altogether all that righteous? Well, it's hard to find a job in which some way people don't sin. That's very difficult. It's hard to find a job that you don't sin. So the question is, what exactly are you doing in life that may or may not be profitable? So I'd like for the young people to rack their brains for just a bit and to give me some examples of what might be considered unlawful trades today, unlawful means of occupation. What are some things that the Bible clearly says we shouldn't do? Give me some ideas. You have one. Assassins? Are you tempted in this area? I suppose there could be a lawful form of being an assassin. But
I was thinking of the other one.
Okay.
I would say pro-abortion centers.
Oh, work. Yeah.
Paying for paid to do that job, and there's nothing wrong with being a nurse or in the medical field.
Well, that's a good distinction. Yeah, that's a good distinction. The comment was made that it's not wrong to be a nurse, but to be employed in an abortion clinic would certainly be a poor misuse of those talents. What else? Is it inherently wrong to be a university professor?
Depends on what you teach.
It depends on what you teach. Yeah, I suppose that's true. Oh, engineering might be in that category. Well, we'll make a note to strike that from the tape. Unless we have an exodus from the denomination. Yeah. Well, there's lots of things that you think of. It'd be wrong to be a prostitute. It's wrong to use your body to commit crimes against the state. It's wrong to use your gifts to write in a treasonous manner for the lawful endeavors of the state. You know, there are lots of things that we have to consider. If you're a soldier, there may be times when you need to disobey an order because it's wrong. When you're in business, perhaps you're ordered to lie to someone. Well, you might have to figure out how to make the best of that situation and withstand the temptation to dishonor God's name. Joseph was involved in many lawful things in his employment, but he was asked to do some unlawful things, and he decided to suffer the consequences rather than going forward with his with what was being asked of him. So it's important when you set out to make sure that what you're about to do will have certain emphases to it, that you are capable of handling those temptations. And in other cases, if you can't, then you might want to look for another line of work or think about another line of work. But it's a gift of God to keep you protected from the temptation that exists in many traits. You have a question over here?
What about a bartender?
What about a bartender? Well, I think it's my conviction, you know, the testimony speaks very clearly, the Reformed Presbyterian testimony speaks very clearly about the, how is it worded? The use and distribution and something of alcohol. I don't remember that section offhand. And I think the Reformed Presbyterian testimony would argue against that as a lawful trade for someone to have. It's certainly been the position of the denomination for many years. But it is a question worth asking if you were to get a job that works in a restaurant where you would maybe bus tables or be a waiter or something and be asked to serve alcohol, and that was against your convictions. You'd certainly have things that you would need to reconcile there, pursue. So it's not always clear-cut, but there are some vocations that are clearly wrong at its face value, and you should not be employed in those things. I think one area that's quite wrong is the area of gambling. And, for instance, let's say you worked for an investment house that specialized in trading in gambling stocks or in pornographic companies. This is it's hard. You cannot deny the profitability of these organizations. And the only thing that's kept the pornography industry from being actively traded on Wall Street is just a sense of decency. There's nothing there to stop anybody from doing it. And there are already what are called soft porn type industries involved in Wall Street, but it's those barriers are dropping. Well, what if you find yourself working at a company that specializes in these things? Do you really want to advance that profit that particular way? It's not altogether an easy decision or distinction to make at times, and so you need to have thoughtfulness put forth as you consider what vocations you might choose. All right, well, another way we look at how God orders our employment is the protection of our goods. Look at protection of our estates is, I think, how it might be worded. And I'd like to read Job 1, verses 9 and 10. This is an interesting passage. It offers some helpful insights, and I have a few notes that Joseph Carl made on this particular point, that this particular passage, that I think will be helpful in seeing how God orders the protection of our estates. In verse 9, chapter 1, "So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him? around his household and around all that he has on every side. You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. Now you can go and read the rest of it, but I'll trust this passage is familiar. One of the things that is difficult in understanding the work of providence is that we don't see ahead of time what God is actively doing in our life. We don't see how he's going to care for us or what he's going to do, and we take these as articles of faith. Obviously, it's something we cannot see. But this is one of those rare instances in scriptures where we see exactly what's going on. We see exactly what's happening in this dialogue between God and Satan. And there are a few points I want to make, and we'll discuss it just briefly, that this hedge that's being referred to around Satan is a clear indication that the protection which God gives to his people and servants is the vexation of Satan and all his instruments. It troubles them extremely that God does so regard and hedge up his people that they cannot come at him. So this is one of those points that really irritates him, is God's care for his people over their estates. That secondly, that Satan, the father of lies, sometimes speaks truth for his own advantage. The devil does lie, but sometimes he does speak the truth if he thinks it'll get the end that he desires. Thirdly, that the people and servants of God dwell in the midst of enemies, in the midst of dangers. Why else need there be a hedge about them? Fourthly, that God himself does undertake the guarding and protecting of his people. God himself does. And then fifthly, you see how far the hedge goes. A hedge not only about his person and household, but about all that he has. Take the meanest thing that he has. God protects it and hedges it about. When we look at the picture of what God is doing in our life, and we're running into danger, perhaps there's opportunity for us to have something of ours taken. House fire, we get in a car wreck, various things. I think this is a very helpful passage in pointing back that God himself is actively protecting the estates of his people. And that whatever happens to us happens out of the tender mercies that God has for us. The very tender mercies. If you're looking at financial ruin in one way or the other, certainly not, I hope, to the severity that Job experienced, but God is at the very center of protecting you. Let's look at the fourth point on suitable calling. And this section, I think, is probably a little puzzling to our ears today. When I read this again, I thought there might be some element to this that is a little hard to appreciate to our modern ears. The idea of God fashioning us for a specific vocation does tend to run counter to the experience we have when we tell people, you can be anything you want to be. Well, if that's true, then how is it that God's fashioning you to be something in particular? Well, I think maybe a perspective of what Flavel might be observing in his own day would be helpful in understanding how it might apply to us. I don't think that people had just a whole lot of options about what kind of life they would lead in a vocational sense 300, 400 years ago. Unless you were a person of means, you might not have had access to much in the way of education, and unless that were the case, you probably couldn't be anything that you wanted to be. Now, certainly there was probably some latitude as to whether or not you might be a silversmith, you might be a carpenter, you might be this or you might be that among trades. And so there was some latitude, but it's not as if you could, say, pack up and move to Florida because you wanted to work for NASA, or pack up and move to Washington because you wanted to work for Microsoft or some such thing, or go to the shipyards and work. The idea of being able to travel long distances very quickly and easily to secure some sort of vocation is completely out of mind. Many years ago, I had a friend of mine who finished his industrial engineering degree, and he was highly sought after. He was a very talented individual and very successful at what he was doing. And it struck me as interesting to watch the application process. His problem was trying to decide where he might work because of the avalanche of people that wanted him to come work for them. And so he would be home for a day or two, then he would fly to this city, and they would interview him, and he'd fly home, and he'd fly to another city. And he was going to many different cities, I think at least 5 or 10, I don't remember which, of solid interviews and offers that he had. Now imagine someone in Flavel's day, they simply wouldn't have had those kinds of options readily available to them. So when you look at the options available to you today, and you say, well, you know, the job market's tight and I can't really get into that program. Well, there have been lots of times in history the job market's been tight. And lots of times people might not have had many options at all in terms of what they would like to do. But just because we have more opportunities to us than maybe others did in times past doesn't mean that God isn't fashioning us for a calling suitable to our frame. In fact, Flavel writes here, if any that fear God shall complain that, although they have a calling, yet it is a hard and laborious one, which takes up too much of their time, which they would gladly employ in other and better work, I answer that it is most likely that the wisdom of providence foresaw this to be the most suitable and proper employment for you. And if you had more ease and rest, you might have more temptations than you now have. The strength and time, which is now taken up in your daily labors, in which you serve God, might otherwise have been spent upon such lusts in which you might have served the devil. Now, in this particular line of thought, he is not prescribing for us that there is only one job that we are allowed to do, and we are never allowed to change that job. But I think what is important to take from this is to step back for just a minute and consider how we might be harmed in various temptations. Now, to that end, I've seen a good many people harmed spiritually in the line of work that they have decided to employ. For instance, they take a job and go somewhere where there's no worthwhile church. There's nothing to attend. There's no Protestant witness there ahead of them. And so they find themselves in a barren, barren land. Well, I don't think that's a wise choice. What about someone who takes a job that provides an unusual level of income for them, and they have a temptation in wanting to be loose in their living when the opportunities preside? Well, I don't think that's a good line of work. It may be well worth your thought to take a job making a lot less money if you're given to spending luxuriously and in harmful ways. For instance, I talked to a man at Synod this last week who told me he was an over-the-road trucker for a few years, and he enjoyed the work, except that it took him away from his family too long. And he decided that when the small children were there, that that was simply not an option for him, and he decided to give up that line of work, though it was suitable to him in other ways. How about traveling salesmen? I've personally known people that have been harmed in very serious ways, committed adultery while out on the road, living a life as a salesman. A lot of temptations come with certain jobs. The glamour of this world is a very thin veneer. It's well worth remembering that. It is a very thin veneer. So the questions that we might ask when we consider where God has placed us in our vocation is, how effectively do we serve God in our current capacity before we worry about changing one area of our life? A change of venue might actually hinder our communion with God in ways completely unanticipated. It's worth your time to do research to make sure that you got the right perspective on this. Not everybody is suitable for every job, and some things are just downright dangerous and should be avoided. So the question is not, are we ever allowed to change our job, that God has fashioned us to do one thing and we're not allowed to do anything else? No, that's not the question. The question to ask is, in relation to all the various spheres of our life, how are we to fashion the argument and consider the options so that in the end our spiritual life is best served? All right, let's move on to chapter 5, and in a way that has a lot of direct applicability. And I'd like to read briefly three passages for us, and I've recorded them there: the Proverbs 19:14, Proverbs 18:22, and Psalm 127:3. The first is, houses and riches are an inheritance from fathers, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. And secondly, he who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. And then finally, behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Now, this first section addresses the choosing of a wife. Now, it's clear that God directs the steps of a man. His ways are indeed ordered in every respect. Now, this fact that God indeed establishes our steps also establishes the need to pray. Remember when we discussed the primary causes and secondary causes and how those things work together? God has ordered us to pray and to pray for a good success in the choosing of a godly spouse. One example that was offered in this particular chapter was that of Abraham's servant who sought Rebekah as a wife for Isaac. He was given to prayer and is seeking God's will that things would be ordered correctly. Now, parents and children have a double burden in regard to praying for a spouse, and that they should pray that God would bring a profitable spouse for their children, and that B, they should pray that God would prepare them to be a profitable spouse for someone else. So, in other words, if it doesn't work for you, don't export it to someone else. Pray and train that it would work well for all. In fact, Flavel writes, there is very much of providence seen in appointing the parties for each other. In this, the Lord often goes beyond our thoughts and plans, yea, and often crosses men's desires and designs to their great advantage. Not what they expect, but what in His infinite wisdom judges best and most beneficial for them takes place. You see, right now, God is working in the hearts and lives of young men and women in other parts of the United States, dare I say, even in this congregation, and in other parts of the world, to bring together people who might even seem loathsome right now. Times change and people change. But it is the consensus of this author that people often get better than we deserve in a spouse. And God is preparing each and every person through the circumstances of life and all their various arenas that we might be blessedly united to someone else. It's well worth taking this picture in prayer. But unfortunately, life is oftentimes neither pleasant nor tidy. And during these times, the doctrine of providence is very helpful when we find ourselves questioning the appropriateness of God's choice for us in either our spouse, our siblings, or our children. Now, there's no question that people irritate us. I'm irritated most of the time. But that's hardly the question, is it? God knows the appropriateness of bringing people into our lives. And there are frequent occasions, if we're honest with ourselves, that the people in our household are just simply a burden. Isn't it? At times, they are a burden. Well, it's true then that we should turn to God and ask Him for the grace and wisdom how to handle these situations. But the temptation to avoid is questioning the choice God has made. You see, the problem exists not because the person is there. The problem exists because God created the situation for that problem to manifest itself. Questioning the choice after it is made is absolutely useless. God selects and designs our families that we might glorify Him. Now, frequently, the end or the aim of glorifying Him is through sanctification, which takes place because of the people He's put in our household. So we get right back to seeing that God's design for us is a spiritual end. So, kids, you might ask yourselves, do you or have your siblings ever bothered you?
No, Mr.
I didn't suspect so, but in case somebody might be less than forthcoming, ask yourself the question, who put them into your home? Who brought them into your life? Who designed them to be part of your family? Who did that? Well, God did. What images... It's our parents' fault. That's right. Yeah. And your parents are saying, what hath God wrought? It works both ways, Bradley. Wait till you have kids. Well, I'd like to propose a metaphor to give you a picture of something that I think is helpful. It's helpful to me. And I hope it will be helpful to you. And that is, I am becoming more and more convinced the older I get that the Christian family is a picture of heaven itself. God's goodness in giving us families. It's a place where we're loved, we're missed, and we're cherished. The worship of God occurs here, as well as enjoying the bounty and all the created order that He has ordained. Now, if your family is not the picture of heaven, it could be that someone snuck in that wasn't supposed to be there. Meaning that, in fact, it could be that you're the problem. But I'm convinced, more so, that our families are a picture of heaven. It is a gift of God to enjoy it. Now, there are lots of warnings given in Scriptures to be very prudent in the choosing of a spouse. Abigail and Nabal were clearly unequally yoked. David and Michael, Job and Mrs. Job, were clearly problematic. There are lots of examples in Scripture of children gone bad. It's not just a spouse. Children go bad sometimes and are a true grievance to their parents. Well, I'd like to move on to this responding to God's blessings in a short sense. That what is it that when you look at what God has given, this gift that He has in fact put forth on the blessings of being in families, that in acknowledging that He has created these things and His providence has clearly ordered them and established all their members, how do we respond to these thoughts? Well, use relations to the end providence designed them. Walk together as co-heirs of the grace of life. Study to be a mutual blessings to each other. So walk in your relations that the parting day might be sweet. Death will shortly break up the family, and then nothing but the sense of duty discharged or the neglects pardoned will give comfort. One day, the irritability of those in our household will soon give way to grief. Grief that we did not do what we were commanded to do. We did not love as we should have loved. And all that will be there is a sense of void and regret. God's given us many ways to care for our families. And we should do so and use those means that God has established for us to a profitable end. I'd like to read a bit of an extended account that was only covered briefly in this book regarding the assiduity and the constancy of the care of God or the care of providence for the saints. Looking at section 3 here. And We're going to cover the section on recording God's providences at length later in, toward the end of this. So I want to skip that for the moment. But one of the things that's important, and you see this as a theme running through the Bible, is the recording of the way God cares for His people. Sometimes through natural, ordinary means, but frequently through means that were unanticipated by the recipients of these gifts. And this is a little bit of an extended account, and I hope you'll bear with me on it, but it was very helpful to me to see the broader context, because if you understand the context a little more clearly, then the blessing of it tends to be of greater value. And that's Flavel recalls the account given of John Knox as recorded by Samuel Clark. Now, Fox, of course, wrote many things about other people, but here is an account of Fox himself. And this was around the time of 1545. Things were very difficult in England during those days. And in fact, I think you could categorize it as they were increasingly desperate. And I want to read a little bit of what was being considered in thought and in culture during that time so that you can see what happened to Fox. That is, that it was thought that the king was the image of God upon earth. To disobey his commands was to disobey God himself. To limit his authority when no limit was laid down was an offense against sovereign. And to make distinctions when the scripture hath made none was an impiety against God. It was indeed acknowledged that this supreme authority might be employed unreasonably or unjustly. But even then, to resist was a crime. It was the duty of the sufferer to submit, and his only resource was to pray that the heart of his oppressor might be changed. His only consolation, to reflect that the king himself would be summoned to answer for his conduct before an unerring tribunal. Henry VIII became a sincere believer in a doctrine so flattering to his pride and easily persuaded himself that he did no more than his duty in punishing with severity the least opposition to his will. In fact, it was noted of Henry that he made it a crime to imagine the king's death. It was a crime to imagine the king's death. That's how far this man had gone in his pride. Well, the choice was clear. Fox lived during these days. You either serve the Pope or you serve Henry. The trouble is, to resist either was to place yourself in grave danger. Fox's biographer notes that the Pope and the king were alike tyrants, and the question was, to which tyrant should the people submit? To the native regal tyrant who gave them a creed and burnt the rejectors of his infallibility, or to the foreign tyrant who inflicted the same merciless severity and taught even more and greater absurdities? Talk about a rock and a hard place. Well, just to give you a picture of the account of the times, in the year 1519, 7 persons were burnt at Coventry for teaching their children and family the Lord's Prayer, the Ten Commandments, in their own language. One of them, named Smith, a widow who had been permitted to return home after receiving a reprimand from Prior Stafford, was attended by the Bishop Sumner. On their way, the officer heard the rustling of parchment in the sleeve of her gown and demanded it from her. It contained the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, and the Ten Commandments in English. The result of the discovery was his compelling the poor victim to return to the bishop, and she was condemned and burnt with the 6 men for having in her possession the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, and the Ten Commandments in English so she could teach her family. Not a Bible. One of it's not even part of the Bible. Such was the state of people in England when Fox was expelled from Oxford. He was expelled from his fellowship. That he was in danger of being apprehended and committed to prison and perhaps burnt as a heretic was evident from the indictment of Athy. Under the king's writ, on the usual charge of speaking words against transubstantiation, he declared that he believed only in the God that was in heaven and not in the God that the priest sold and the baker's wife made. So, this sort of flippant attitude was common among many, and some did recant, but I wasn't sure if they were recanting their flippancy or from what they meant. Now, Fox, at this point, had enjoyed only a minimal amount of support from his family and was, in fact, on the run, and his own family was quite hesitant to even be associated with him because he was being pursued. They knew he was condemned and deserving of death. But he had decided that great cities are great solitudes. He would be less observed and obtained a livelihood more easily in a great city. His life would be more safe from spies and informers. Prudence demanded instant concealment. The usual result of reasoning followed, and Fox repaired to London for greater safety in his daily bread. As Master Fox one day sat in St. Paul's Church, spent with long fasting, his countenance thin, his eyes hollow, after the ghastly manner of dying men, everyone shunning a spectacle of so much horror, there came to him one whom he never remembered to have seen before, who, sitting down by him and saluting him with much familiarity, thrust an untold sum of money into his hand, bidding him be of good cheer, adding withal that he knew not how great the misfortunes which were oppressed him, but supposed it was no light calamity, that he should therefore accept in good part this small gift from his countrymen, which common courtesy had forced him to offer, that he should go and take care of himself, and take all occasions to prolong his life, adding that withal a few days new hopes were at hand, and a more certain condition of livelihood. Fox never could never learn to whom he was indebted for this seasonal bounty, though he used every endeavor to find that person. Certain it is, however, that within 3 days after the transaction, the presage was made good. One of them waited upon him from the Duchess of Richmond, who invited him, upon fair terms, into her service, where he went later and became a tutor to the children, I think, of the Earl of Surrey, if I'm not mistaken. So you see this man on the run. He's got a family. His own immediate family and his in-laws wouldn't take him, and he decided the best place to hide was in a crowd. But he was so gaunt that he was spotted at a church, and a man came and gave him an undisclosed amount of money and begged him to do everything he could to prolong his life that he might be able to glorify God. And he did. He later wrote a wonderful history of the martyrology of the church. All right, in the last section under providence and provision, and that is the wisdom of God in providing for the way that he does. Sometimes the things of this world get in the way. God is very concerned about what we have and why we have it. wise providence considers our conditions as pilgrims and strangers, and so allots the provision that is needful for our passage home. It knows the mischievous influence of fullness and excess upon most men, though sanctified, and how apt it is to make them remiss and forgetful of God. You see, this was one of the warnings that Moses gave to the children of Israel during the Exodus. You're going to have lots of things given to you when you come into the new land, and you're going to forget God. And he warned them. He warned them to remember that God had delivered them, that God, in fact, had provided for them. As was mentioned earlier, regarding prayer for family members, the same is true for prayer in our temporal needs. God knows what, when, and how much we need. Flavel again writes that the wisdom of providence is also greatly revealed in the manner of dispensing our portion to us. And many times, it allows our wants to pinch hard and many fears to arise with a design to magnify the care and love of God in the supply. Providence so orders the case that faith and prayer come between our wants and supplies. You like that? Faith and prayer come between our wants and supplies, and that the goodness of God may be more magnified in our eyes thereby. Forgetting former mercies and provisions are sure recipes for building distrust and worry. God will not forget his people, but they oftentimes do forget him. His commitment to care for his people is great. It's well worth bringing to mind and calling to remembrance those ways in which God has provided for us. All right, we'll take a couple of questions here before we dismiss.
I want a little bit of having come from a Baptist background, I want a little more elaboration on your stance on the partaking of adult beverages.
No. God is in heaven, and I am on the earth. Therefore, let your words be few. Next. Any other comments or questions?
Will you answer them?
No. Not necessarily.